the regular meeting, House Labor and Commerce Committee. Time is 1:15. January 24th, 1985. Members present, Representative Kopanen, Representative Hanley, Representative Collins, and myself, Representative Navar. Representative Doctor called and said that he would be a little bit late, so we'll expect him shortly. And Representative Pierce says, just direct. We also have present Representative Larson, who will be testifying on this bill, House Bill 40, which is an appropriations bill for making a special appropriation for the Iditarod sled dog race. Has everyone who wishes to testify signed in? The other bill that was scheduled for today has been canceled. I sent you all a memo. In place, Carol Dirfner will be offering an overview of boards and commissions, since we have so many to confirm this year. With that, we'll take up House Bill 40, bill making a special appropriation for the Iditarod sled dog race. And Representative Larson, would you like to testify?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have just a few brief comments in relation to this bill, and then I'll turn it over to my aide, Mr. Ed Grasser. He has the backup information and will be able to answer any questions that you have. But 2 years ago, when I was first elected to the state legislature, I kind of adopted something that formerly had been carried on by Representative Jack Fuller, and that was to carry the annual Iditarod bill to the legislature. The bill that you had before you this year would call for funding of the various things as indicated in the back material that we've given you, to the tune of about $72,000. And $72,000, Mr. Chairman, is part of a total budget that is approaching now over $500,000. The Iditarod, I think, as all of you folks know, has been a very popular sporting event in Alaska. In fact, it has now extended not only to Alaska, but through Canada, to the rest of the United States, and even Europe. And this year, I think we're having a musher even from Japan coming over to participate. So Alaska does get a lot of publicity, both nationally and internationally, as a result of this sporting event. So that it isn't only a recreational event, it's an event now that generates a lot of interest in our state, helps in the development of tourism, and so forth. And as a result, of course, once again, I'd appreciate any consideration that you folks could give in helping me obtain the appropriation this year for the Iditarod Committee. I'd be most happy to answer any questions that you have, or any detailed questions we have Mr. Grasser here.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Larson, just a question. Did you say the total budget, annual budget, or this year is anticipated to be $500,000?
Approximately.
So this would be just a supplement or a small portion of that total?
This is a portion of that total. I might just add, too, if I may, Mr. Chairman, as a little sidelight, the city of Wasilla is at this time donating or leasing at a nominal fee, I think $1 a year, 9.7 acres of land within the city of Wasilla, which will be used for the Iditarod headquarters location, which will also have as the idea there of a tourist site to promote tourism and development in the area.
I'd like to add as an observation that while I was growing up in Kenai, we had sled dog races there. It was the highlight of our winter. So I'm very much in support of that. Yeah, I did run, and with your permission, I'd like to sign on as a co-sponsor. For the record, Representative Davis has now joined us.
Okay, if I may be excused, we have a Finance Committee meeting now, but any questions you have, we have Mr. Grasser here. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Did you wish to make a presentation?
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think Representative Larson already has. But I'll answer any questions if there are any.
Okay, would you just state your name as a record?
Okay. My name is Ed Grasser. I'm the aide to Representative Larson.
Thank you. Representative Hanlon.
Just one more question. I think Representative Larson said that he had taken over from Representative Fuller in introducing this. Has this been an annual appropriation?
Yes,
has it been something that's been done every... So this is just kind of going through the motions of... Okay. It's not a first, it's...
No, this has been going on for several years.
I guess that was my question, too. We have a race up in Fairbanks, too, that you might be...
Well, I guess that was my next question. Who else is going to, you know... Yeah.
But my question is how many years have we funded it? I know we did fund it last year. I was just wondering just how many years have we funded it? Do you know what that is?
I'm not sure, but I think this is for
Mr. Chairman, and one other question. Do you know if this is sort of a lump sum money that they can use for prize money, whatever? Is there a letter of intent that goes with that, which indicates just what it would go for?
Yeah, none of this money is intended for prize money. It's all for race expenses. I don't know if that's in the bill, but it should be included.
I know, I realize that, but just for your own information, if I could continue, Mr. Chairman. That was one of the concerns that people had in money that went for Yukon Quest was that it was money for expenses. I guess it says that, but I'm just wondering if there's some kind of if there's some limitation actually in what they do spend it, because if they have a budget of $380,000, then $70,000 or $100,000 goes to the prize money. And, see what I'm saying? It's kind of hard to, it all goes into a lump sum. It's kind of like a general fund, so.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, but hopefully the intent of the legislation is they'll follow it, I guess. I don't think anybody followed up on it last year after the appropriation was made. I don't know.
It might be nice at some point just to have a letter of intent written with the legislation when we pass it out of the House. I'll work with Representative Larson on that.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's all I have.
Thank you. Representative Copeland.
Is it appropriate at this time? I'd like to move to pass the House Bill 40 out of the committee to the next committee of referral with individual recommendations.
Are there any objections? So moved.
Motion on.
Thank you.
Now we'll give it to Alan.
Brad, do we have that bill to sign?
I'm sorry.
Do we have that to sign? Do we have the bill to sign?
Co-sign and co-sponsor this to me. So then I'll get support for him.
Okay, we'll, I guess, have that available for signing in a few moments before the end of the committee meeting. Now we have Carol Dirkner from the Boards and Commissions office, and she's going to give us an overview.
Hello. It's nice to see old faces. It's nice to see new faces.
Old faces?
We don't look so old. I am Carol Dirkner, and I am Special Assistant to Governor Bill Sheffield, and I am responsible for boards and commissions appointments in the governor's office, as well as judiciary appointments, honorary appointments, task force, and special committee appointments, and I handle something known as special projects from time to time. I will be presenting to you in the next few minutes an overview of the boards and commissions system, is what we call it. I will also be providing the same overview to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee next week sometime. And what I I would like to do at this time is if I could just run through a little presentation and then open it up for questions. I will end the presentation with some very specific comments pertaining to the boards and commissions, pending legislation, confirmation of those boards and commissions that will be coming directly to this committee for activity. Okay? We view boards and commissions as an arm of government. When Governor Sheffield was elected, he asked if I would take on this particular job with an eye to taking a look at boards and commissions that existed in the state, what they did, how long they've been in place, that type of thing. So when we came into this particular situation, what we discovered was a very large amount of disparate and non-comprehensive information on boards and commissions. The governor has added a great deal of emphasis in his office structure to the boards and commissions function that was not previously there under earlier administrations. What we found was that indeed we are dealing with an arm of government. It's not an elected arm. It is an appointed arm, but it is around 3,000 to 4,000 people big as an arm of government. That's as large as the Department of Transportation and many of the other major departments of state government. It is an interesting arm of government because it is a hybrid in many ways. They, as I said, are not elected by the population. They are appointed by the governor. In many cases, that appointment power is shared with the legislature, so it's a kind of a hybrid group. For administrative purposes, they are attached to departments of state government. But we found out when we got here that there was very little communication that took place between these boards and commissions and the state departments. As a matter of fact, we found that many of them thought they were autonomous when indeed they weren't, and others who were autonomous really knew they were quite autonomous from anybody. When we looked into it, what we found was that there was, in reality, in this arm of government, two very distinct systems, one being the official state boards and commissions system, which is the one I deal with primarily out of my office. Those are those boards that are created by statute, created by Alaska state law. Then there is another branch of this, another sub-level, if you will, that are unofficial. Advisory committees, task forces, blue ribbon committees, etc., that are created by some other instrument, but not by law, usually an administrative order, or as a adjunct to accepting federal funds for a specific type of program. For example, I'll give an example of those type of advisory committees, which I will not be addressing here today. In the Department of Education, you have something like 27 advisory committees. You have the hot lunch advisory committee, and then we have the school lunch advisory committee. Each of those advisory committees is as a result of accepting federal funds for a particular type of program. In most of those situations, the appointments are made by the commissioner of a department as opposed to the governor of a state. What I will be dealing with here today are those in which the governor makes an appointment, those that are created by statute that has been passed by the legislature in our state. In December of 1982, what we found was that there were no centralized records kept of any of this information. And so for almost the first year, what we attempted to do was to centralize that record keeping and indeed to automate it, which we now have done. We found that nobody could tell us how many official boards and commissions there actually were, and nobody could tell us how many positions there were on those boards and commissions. And every day, somebody would call up and say, when are our appointments going to be made to such and such board? And it was a board that didn't show up on anybody's list of records. But when you checked the law, you found it sooner or later somewhere in a piece of legislation. What we found in December of 82 is that there were over 1,000 positions on official state boards and commissions. There were 135 boards in existence at that particular time. We looked at them historically and realized that the majority of those boards had been created in the late 1970s, in that one period of time. A very few boards were created in the earlier part of statehood, but obviously there was some sort of a public dynamic or a political dynamic that came into play in the 70s in which the system of boards and commissions and public advisory bodies just kind of mushroomed. We also looked at if there were any statistics kept on the gender makeup of those boards, the minority makeup, the geographic representation, and indeed no specific records had been kept, so we sat down and tried to do some estimates. What we estimated in December of 82 was that 80% of all people occupying an official position on an official state board or commission were male. 20% were female. We estimated that 90% of all of those positions were occupied by Caucasians. 10% were occupied by people who were non-Caucasian. And about 5% were occupied by Alaska Natives. That's as far as we could break it down just by guesstimating, if you will. We also can estimate at that time that 80% of all the people who sit on state boards and commissions came from Anchorage, Fairbanks, or Juneau. And a very small number, very small percentage, came from places outside of those three urban centers of our state. We also realized that there was no uniformity at all to the laws that had created all these boards and commissions. They had just been developed one upon one, and nobody had ever looked at the system or uniformity of anything to do with the system. And there appeared to be a great deal of confusion over what all these boards did, the scope of the authority that they had or did not have, the importance of the work that they were fulfilling, who they were accountable to, how much money they expended on an annual basis, and to some people's mind, more importantly, how much money did they control. The governor asked us in 1983 in our office if we would conduct an extensive inventory of this system. For the first, I think, 8 months, we just kind of tap danced and tried to put out fires. We did put on a researcher for a while on a contract with us and did get involved in a very extensive inventory. It was composed of two parts, a very objective questionnaire that was sent to the chairman of each board as well as the staff person of each board, and then a two-hour face-to-face interview with either the chairman or other members of the board and the staff of each board. And out of that, we developed a number of, we've developed a great deal of information that we do not believe has ever been gathered before in the state. One of the interesting statistics we found out of that is that 76% of all the seats on boards and commissions are highly restricted by the legislature as to who can be appointed. Only 24% are open to free choice by the governor. The public is rather confused about that. The public very often applies to sit on a board or commission, not understanding that these restrictions are in place. We get 60, 70 resumes a day in our office from the public of people who want to serve on boards and commissions. There's a great deal of interest in the state to serve the public service along these lines. Those restrictions can range from must be from the first judicial district, must have held a professional license for 5 years prior to appointment, must be male, must be female, must be, you know, there's a whole line of restrictions. We feel, although we have not approached it yet, that that kind of designated seat, if you will, although we understand the balance of powers and the check and balance, does serve as some sort of an impediment to the public to be able to serve in state government. We have not done anything about that yet. We just wish to bring this to your attention at this time. We also found that there were a great many communication problems that these boards felt that they were experiencing. They did not understand the legislative process. They did not understand the budget process. They didn't understand the administration. They don't understand the Administrative Procedures Act. They don't understand the role of the Attorney General's office. So we would put these people on these boards and then not provide them with the tools they needed to understand the role they had as a public official. We also developed a profile for each of the boards, which then gave us for the first time the frequency of the meetings that they held on an annual basis, what the time commitment was to be expected of every person that was appointed, and that came as a shock in many ways. For example, 125 days for somebody to the Workers' Compensation Board. Try to find somebody whose employer will let them serve for 125 days on a board, 168 days for the Board of Fisheries. I mean, rather shocking time commitments we found in this. We also found that these boards spent $2 million in 1983 in travel alone. Of that $2 million in travel, 1.5 of it was for board members to travel to meetings inside the state. 400,000 of it was for travel outside of the state of Alaska. by either board members or staff members. We also found that these boards hired consultants in 1983 to the tune of about $500,000. Those are not state employees. We also found that the boards as a group did not avail themselves very frequently of the teleconferencing system that's established in the state. When we asked them why they didn't, we found that in many cases they were worried about the legality of votes taken by teleconference, and they also felt that the interaction that took place in a face-to-face meeting was as important as the ability to discuss by teleconference on a particular issue. They all did say that if they received training in teleconferencing, and if the ambiguities about the legality of the votes taken could be cleared up, that they might avail themselves to that more frequently. As a result of this rather extensive interview process, and if at any time you want some real in-depth view of a particular board, you just need to call our office and we can provide to you our interview notes, the questionnaires that they filled out, etc. And we have each of that. We have one of those on each of these particular boards in giant binders. But as a result of this, Governor Sheffield sat down and developed kind of a three-pronged policy approach, if you will, to the whole issue of boards and commissions. Number one, I think the governor took a very strong commitment to the fact that this is indeed the public advisory system of state government. This is one of the ways in which the public has a very strong involvement with decision-making in government, and that the goal was not to eliminate this system at all, but the goal was to try to manage this system a little more effectively than it had been managed in the past, and to try to make the system more efficient. If that meant that we tried to eliminate boards that had been on the statutes for a long time that were dormant, but there was confusion as to whether they were alive or dormant, that we might take that approach. Also, that we would try to make more effective communications back and forth between the administration and these boards as to exactly what their role was as policymakers and as public officials. That we would identify with the boards, in concert with the boards, any impediments that they felt were really problematic for them, and that included pieces of legislation that they wanted or problems that they had that could only be dealt with by legislation. We would also increase the number of women that were appointed to these boards. We would increase the number of minorities that were appointed to these boards. And we would increase representation on these boards from geographic regions all over the state. We have done a great deal of that at this time. We have targeted certain communities that have never had any representation on these state boards or commissions in the past. Another area that we felt very strongly that we would try to do was to slow down the creation of new boards and commissions by actually seeing if we could get people to justify their reasons for wanting a board or commission more clearly than perhaps they had in the past. And that we would also encourage the use of more flexible vehicles such as task forces and committees to solve specific problems as opposed to statutorily creating a new board or commission that has a lifespan forever. We've been successful in some of these areas. We also feel that we needed to have in the administration a stronger presence during the sunset review process. It is our understanding that the sunset review process is indeed a legislative process. It is not an executive branch process. But we are frequently asked and encouraged to have a viewpoint, and we have been participating, as I understand it, stronger than in previous administrations have been in those sunset processes. And that we would see what we could do to broaden the restrictions on some of these seats so that we could provide more flexibility, more opportunities for more Alaskans to be appointed. Also, lastly, the governor took a very strong commitment to the fact that he would like very much to be able to avail, to have Alaskans have the opportunity to serve on boards and commissions. Governor Sheffield has only reappointed about 25% of all the people on the boards and commissions since he's been here. So that he has created a lot of opportunities for Alaskans who've never been able to serve on a board, to serve on a board. We do try to keep some reappointments there for continuity in the behavior of the boards. Now that is the overview of the entire system of boards and commissions, but let me bring you down to more specifically those that you will have in this committee coming before you, and those are the occupational licensing boards to a large extent. The occupational licensing boards are a real interesting group. What we found is that more than any of the other boards or commissions, they have common features. There are 19 of those boards in existence at this time. We regulate and license in the state of Alaska right now 98 professions. One out of every five people in the state of Alaska receives a license from the Division of Occupational Licensing in the Department of Commerce. That's a very high percentage compared to a lot of other states. Let me read to you the definition of occupational licensing that has been accepted and which we have to live by according to the federal government. Occupational licensing is a process by which an agency of government grants permission to an individual to engage in a given occupation upon finding that the applicant has attained the minimum degree of competency required to ensure that the public's health and safety and welfare is reasonably well protected. That is the official definition that government, starting from the federal level going on down here, must follow to a certain extent. We identified when we did our inventory that these occupational licensing boards were all experiencing certain common problems. They do not understand how government works. They all felt they did not have enough money to do what it was that they were by statute charged to do. They felt there was not enough staff support out of the Department of Commerce to provide that level of service that they felt the public should get. They were all experiencing a rather staggering increase in the last 5 years in the number of people who wished to be licensed, new applicants, a lot of them coming in from outside the state. They also felt that there was a fragmentation of effort, that a lot of new boards and commissions were being either created or bills were in to create new ones, that many of the existing boards felt fragmented the efforts that they were already working in. They also felt very strongly that there was a lack of enforcement and investigation of complaints that were being made by the public over bad practices, unlicensed activity, what have you. Now, government people were also experiencing their own problems with these boards, and I'd like to share a little bit of those with you. We have experienced at the Attorney General's office, in the Department of Occupational Licensing, and in my own office, that many of these boards have a certain amount of identity problems. They get appointed to these boards to serve the public purpose of protection, but every once in a while they get confused over their role as a practitioner in an industry. So every once in a while the boards very dangerously tread close to antitrust and monopolistic behavior through the writing of the regulations that they are charged to write. As a matter of fact, the federal government has pointed this out to us on a couple of occasions in recent years, especially the U.S. Justice Department. We also felt that in some cases the boards had passed illegal regulations, had not listened to the Attorney General's advice, and then refused to rescind those illegal regulations. We also experienced the fact that there were a lot of industry groups out there that wanted new boards to be created. In questioning why, we felt in some cases the primary reason was not the protection of the public, but the validation of their own new profession. The boards we found were dealing with a great many conflicting statutes and conflicting laws. There was jurisdictional problems between the health professional boards that were embedded in statute and in law. We, in the governor's office, experienced a great deal of difficulty in finding members of the public to serve on occupational licensing boards. We find a lot of licensees who wish to serve on those boards, but the public seat, the consumer seat, if you will, there is not a great big rush out of the public to sit on these boards. They're either not sexy enough or glamorous enough or what have you, but it's real hard sometimes to find somebody who to sit there who will participate fully as a representative of the public. And another thing that we felt but could not document was that the fees for licensing were ridiculously low in the state of Alaska, and that we were expending more and more general fund money that was not commensurate with the amount of revenue brought in by licensing fees charged back to the applicants. As a result of all of these discussions and perceptions, we decided we couldn't figure out who was telling the truth and what was what. So what we did was we ordered a management audit of the Division of Occupational Licensing through the Office of Management and Budget. And you have a copy of that. I believe I submitted it to Roger, the chairman, and he has made copies available to find out exactly what was going on in terms of that division. What we found was that there really is indeed a staggering increase in the workload of that division over the last 5 years. What we also found out was that increase is due to a rather incredible number of new licensees applying for licenses from other parts of the country. People who are, I guess this is in proportion to the population growth of our state. Another thing we found out was that there was a problem in investigation and enforcement of complaints. Oddly enough, one of the things we found out was that the majority of complaints that are filed are not filed by the public, they're filed by other practitioners and other licensees, which was, for the first time, something that was really rather remarkable for us to look at. We also did a financial audit of the cost of providing occupational licensing, the state function of occupational licensing. And for the first time, we factored in all the cost that it takes the state to provide this function. That includes the Division of Occupational Licensing and its staff. That includes the Attorney General's Office. And we specifically tied their costs to specific boards here and there, and to the investigative unit of the Division of Occupational Licensing. And what we found out is when we took that cost and we compared it to the amount of revenues generated off this licensing fee, we have about a $500,000 gap. And that some boards' fees were carrying other boards to a large extent. For example, the contractors bring in a great deal of revenue to the state through licensing fees, but a number of the boards, it's a big drain on the state treasury to provide this licensing function for them. We brought together, for the first time, they tell me, in the history of the state, a joint meeting of all the chairmen of the licensing boards, and they met with the governor's office, the attorney general's office, and the Division of Occupational Licensing, as well as the Commissioner of Commerce. 40 or so people were in that room, also some people from the management and budget office. 40 people were in the room. Everybody told me that they wouldn't be able to sit in the room all day without beating each other up. But the meeting was absolutely amazing, I must tell you. They were very pleased to be invited jointly to talk joint problems for the first time. We asked them if they would review the current status of occupational licensing in the state of Alaska, and then if they would help us identify specific problems that they were experiencing, and then to prioritize those problems as a group. And then if they would help us think through creating solutions. They did that. And we have, and I believe you have, a copy of those issues that they identified as priorities for activity either by your branch or by the administration. And I am pleased to say that as of this time, the administration has asked for an increase in the Occupational Licensing Division budget. And you will see that in your operating budget. They identified that as a major problem they were facing. We have restored in that budget travel funds that they felt were a major problem for meetings. We have instituted the beginnings of a training program, if you will, for these board members so that they don't get confused as to their role on these boards. And we have authored several pieces of legislation that you either have already or will be receiving the first part of next week. One of those is a bill that provides some uniformity to Title VIII occupational licensing statutes, removes as many of the conflicts of jurisdiction and activity in those that we have been able to identify. We have also submitted to you a bill that takes the fee structure for boards and commissions out of statute, where it is terribly inflexible, and puts it into regulation where the board and the department must agree on a fee structure and then go out to public hearing on that fee structure. The boards felt particularly strong that if they had that flexibility, they would be able to increase their fees. In this particular case, that piece of legislation that we have submitted to you is identical to three other pieces of legislation that have been submitted to me by two other governors. It is obviously an issue that over and over and over again has been brought to the attention of the legislature, and we really hope very much that we can have good dialogue on it. In the past, there appears not to have been any dialogue on it. Maybe it wasn't hot enough or glamorous enough to ever make it through in a short period of time. But the board members have requested some time to be able to testify on that bill when the bill comes before your committee. And we have said that we would work with the staff of the committee to organize that when it comes before you. And also, you will be receiving, I believe, on Monday, a bill through the Department of Administration that erases the ambiguities on votes taken over teleconferencing. And the board members would also like to provide some supportive testimony on that. That's basically where we are at this particular time. In terms of the operating budget for the Division of Occupational Licensing, I believe we have requested the addition of three new staff members for that division. Those positions came out of our discussion with the boards. And they identified in their minds which were the most important. And after some analysis of that and with the Office of Management and Budget and the governor, concurred that that was probably a good way to go on those positions. In terms of the sunset, you will be having a number of sunset audits. I will be available to come and testify to you on what the governor's position might be on any one of those sunset bills. It's always fun and it's always interesting to see all the constituents come into sunset hearings. We do concur to a large extent with the findings of the Legislative Budget and the Audit Committee that has done all the preliminary audit work on those hearings and have had some good discussions with them in the intervening year or so as to the purpose of sunset and the role of the administration in that sunset process. That's basically all I have to say. I hope that gives you a little overview. I could talk forever. I have been known to do that. If you have any questions, I'll try to answer them.
Thank you. I'm sure there are a number of questions. Representative Collins.
I'd like to know a little bit more on what guidelines or criteria is used to determine whether a board or commission is really necessary.
Well, that is a real problem. There is no written criteria that we could find in law. It appears to be something that comes out of the legislature. Some states have adopted, we have sunset legislation. Some states have adopted sunrise legislation as the nickname for it, I think, which is a process and a criteria established in law that every time a new board or commission is to be established, must go through this process in order to justify that all alternatives have been looked at, all options have been looked at, that a public purpose is being served by this or what have you. We had thought at some point about submitting some legislation along those lines, but felt that that was more of a legislative body's priority prerogative than it would be an administration's prerogative.
Representative Pierce.
Thank you, through the chair. How many people do we have who are serving on more than one board of commission? Out of the 960.
Very few. I've never counted them, but some of the boards require a designated seating, cross-seating, if you will. For example, the State Personnel Board requires that one of their members also sit on the State Labor Relations Board and another on the Teacher Retirement Board and what have you. Very few of them are written that way, though. We have a number of commissioners of departments that are designated by legislation to sit on all kinds of different boards. As a matter of fact, it's kind of a tricky question every once in a while, the number of boards that the commissioners sit on. Very time-consuming.
Well, also, Mr. Sheriff, if I could, I'm a little bit confused. You say that the governor wants to create opportunities and wants public members, and on the other hand, you say that it's hard to find public members to sit on some of these boards, but yet you're getting 60 applications, resumes a day.
Right.
I'm evidently missing something. If you're getting 60 or 70 applications a day or resumes, why is it difficult to find those public members?
Because most of the people have not requested, for example, to sit on the dispensing opticians board, but they have requested to sit on the permanent fund board or the Board of Education or something like that. There are I mean, in the people's mind, there are ones that are real important, and there are ones that apparently are not perceived to be so important.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Carol. Thank you for the overview. It's very informative. The question I have is on what kind of process do you go in determining selection of board members? You sift through all these members or potential appointees and then make recommendations to the governor? Is that kind of the way it goes?
Generally, the first thing that I do is make a kind of a matrix of what's needed on the board. I take a look at the existing membership of the board, the geographic balance of the board, the gender balance, the ethnic balance. Then I read the statutes and I start to figure out what the restrictions are by law as to who can sit on the board. And then I usually call the agency person and find out what's needed at a given time on the board. If they're going to take up a certain issue in the next 2 or 3 years, they need somebody with a particular kind of background, you know, that kind of thing, in an issue area or something like that. Classic example, in the Board of Nursing recently, people are taking up the nurse practitioner's regulations. They ask. Once I get all of that done, then I go to the files and I pull out all the resumes and all the notes and all the telephone conversations of people that have expressed an interest in a particular board, and then I start trying. It's almost like an executive search process, piecing together that. And then I take them to the governor in a discussion with the governor.
Representative Davis?
Just on how to exactly phrase this. You were talking about the board, some of your discussions, we found that some of the board members weren't real familiar with the appeal process and Administrative Procedures Act. And I guess I've had a number of constituents that are concerned about they didn't feel like they were handled well in when they took the boards. So their recourse would be through, I guess, not you, of course, but through the Mr. Traeger in his office and that.
Right.
But I just sort of for your information, I suppose, I've heard that from constituents, but from the people that are at the other end that are have taken the test and not realize, you know, what they have as an appeal, or not real clear on that direction.
I think it's a problem. And I don't believe that the boards very frequently articulate that to the applicants as to an appeal process. For example, if somebody disagreed with their score on a test,
and
as to what the formal appeal process is. It's appealed to the board, it's appealed to the division, and then if there's no remedy there, it's appealed to the Attorney General's office. And the last appeal, of course, is court of law.
I think the PO process indicates, so that I realize that's not really your department, and that's probably not fair, but I think there's only, it's a fairly short time in the appeal process, isn't that correct? 15 mm-hmm. days?
Something like that. And they need to write a written request for an appeal, as I understand it.
So if someone sort of lost, didn't get that, understand that in the first place, they're kind of lost twice, then, didn't they?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for the discussion.
Representative.
Yes, I was looking here at the draft and the licensing costs and revenues. The individual boards establish the fees for licensing?
Established by the legislature in statute.
I was looking at this. There's very few of them. There's an allocated state cost in that one column, and then revenues. And as you mentioned, contractors have a much greater revenue than they do as far as state costs going into it. But that's, and then electrical administration or whatever that is also comes out with more revenue. They're about the only two. And looking at the dental board, some of these highly professional, highly, I would think, incomes that would be pretty substantial too, that probably, I guess I wouldn't envision that kind of discrepancy or that kind of difference between what the state is putting in and what the revenue is.
It was the first time that we were able to pull these figures together this way. In the Sunset Audit in the past, what they used was one component of the Division of Occupational Licensing's budget, which was the direct cost of the state for the board to hold meetings and travel and stuff like that. In reality, there are three components to that budget, the investigative unit, the administrative unit, and the board meeting unit. And we added those three together,
And then we also factored in the Attorney General's time that is spent with each board, and it's considerable. And whatever other costs we could identify specifically. And came as a big surprise to everybody when we, and what we were trying to do was to get at what is the true cost of having this board.
And just a follow-up question, did you say then that the legislature establishes the licensing fees so that if someone had a complaint, I think someone indicated to me they had a complaint about what it costs in Alaska for a medical license to be renewed, that's a decision that has been made by the legislature.
Right. And some of the boards in recent years have had their fees increased by the legislature. They've come and said, we think you ought to raise it. What the boards would like to do this year is to have those fees taken out of statute, put into regulation, and they would like the check and balance, if you will. They don't want the department to have that authority alone. They, the board, wants to do that in concert with the department. So in the fee bill that you have in front of you coming down, I think it you have it, but I don't think you've had a hearing on it yet, we did put that into the bill, that the board and the department must agree, and then they go out to public hearing on raising the fees. That gives everybody a lot more flexibility. Sometimes the board knows that it's going to go through a pretty costly process over the next year. They're going to rewrite their exam. They have to bring in an exam expert from outside the state to do that. Or they're involved in litigation that's going to be protracted or something like that. And it's quite possible that they will need to raise those fees for that period of time or something like that.
Representative Copeland?
Yeah, I just comment that, of course, we're looking at the statutes in the last 2 years in a different board, we found that in some cases the fees have been set with the original establishment of the board and have never been raised. There has been a trifle of inflation in a few areas.
They seem to be uniformly pretty low, except for the medical board, which got this raised last year.
Okay, that one, I guess that's this one particular doctor was complaining about.
I'd like to just ask something for clarification. You said that 76% of the total positions are filled by designated members. When you say that that was somewhat misleading because it's only within certain constraints, isn't it? That, I mean, they're still open to the public, but with designated by maybe different sectors of the public.
They are open to the public, but with lots of restrictions. The public is confused about that.
How many of them would you say are under real stringent restrictions, and which one would you say, and what percentage?
Of the 76%, I'd say about 70% are highly restricted. Very, very. I have to tell you that sometimes it feels like looking for needles in haystacks. It really does sometimes. And we leave positions open and vacant for a while if we can't find the person that fit the statute.
One other question I have. If the fees of some of the boards were increased in order to cover most of the cost or a greater percentage of the cost, then would that change your opinion on which one should be sunsetted or which one should be continued?
I'm not sure. I think the cost to the state of a particular licensing function is only one element of of that kind of decision. There are sometimes some real dangers out there to the public in unlicensed activity. And I think that the overriding question that always has to be asked in a sunset process is, what is the public purpose to be served by the continuation of this board? And if there is no public purpose, or a minor public purpose, then what optional or alternative ways do we have of protecting the public if we get rid of this board? And there are a variety of optional ways that very often the industry and trade groups never look at or don't wish to look at.
Representative Belcher.
Mr. Chairman, Carol, do you have a list of those boards that you're having difficulty getting citizens on?
By and large, they're the occupational licensing boards, and they're the public seats.
Well, do you specifically have a list of the positions and what they might do and what have you? I know that there are people who would like to serve. Maybe the information doesn't get out to them.
Okay.
And I'm sure that both Virginia, myself, would like to get a list out to our people and say, hey, would you like to serve? Rule number one, our community council, the following vacancies exist. You know, sometime do we really try? And having seen this, I'm pleased to see that this has now got a certain degree of professionality to it. You know, it was, hey, if you can't make somebody a deputy commissioner or something, good old boy down here, he helped me in precinct XYZ. Well, let's make him this or that. And it appears that this, obviously this is politics that we're dealing in, and you like to put the people in that have helped you, and that's understandable, huh? But there are probably a lot of citizens out there that would like to serve, mm-hmm. and they don't have to have a big brownie button or something mm-hmm. like that. They'd be kind of honored to serve on it. Would you feel? I'd like a list of those.
Or just
what the qualifications are, maybe we can help you with a little bit of recruiting here.
We have attempted a number, or we have just instituted in the last year, a number of public outreach things that are actually being helpful. Mm-hmm. We now publish the boards and commissions annual directory, which I believe all of you have a copy of. They're going like hotcakes, so don't give yours away. They really are. Mm-hmm. We publish a monthly vacancy list, and that list is distributed to the legislative information offices around the state, the governor's regional offices, places like that. And we also send a quarterly outreach mailing to not-for-profit organizations, you know, like women's organizations, native organizations, trade organizations. We have a mailing list that we keep compiling and adding to. And that is sent out quarterly, listing vacancies coming up over the next quarter, something like that. It's been very helpful. But a number of these occupational licensing boards just don't capture people's imagination in terms of that public seat. And I have relied to a great extent on word of mouth, calling somebody saying, do you know somebody who would like to be on the dispensing competitions board to represent them? I'm looking out. They'll say, no, but I've got somebody for the such and such board. I'll be glad to give you, make sure that each of you get our monthly vacancy list.
That'd be great.
It's real helpful.
And a little bit about that board, so when you, okay.
Excuse me. Representative Hannah.
Before coming down to Juneau, after the election, I was at a function, and I think Senator Strzelczewski was approached, and I was approached about the fact that vendors, whatever, can come in and sell hearing aids. That there is no regulation that anyone can come up and take advantage of some of these people, put a big ad in the paper, whatever, do some kind of a test. I don't know how accurate, and sell hearing aids. What has to happen to prevent that kind of abuse, or and is that true? I mean, there was a deaf person there at the time and indicated that anybody, any fly-by-night outfit as well as very legitimate outfits can come in, but some of these handicapped people can really be taken advantage of by the person out to make a fast buck.
Well, as I understand it, in our state, is Mr. Traeger here? No. As I understand it, in our state, there are three or four levels of licensing that can be done. Licensing, as we know it by a board, is the most elaborate and the most formal. There's also certification and a variety of other things that can be done administratively through the Department of Commerce. For example, everybody who sells hearing aids could be made to fill out certain forms and adhere to certain criteria, and then that is monitored administratively by the Department of Commerce. And we have encouraged industry groups that are worried about this, or public groups that are worried about this, to take a look at that kind of function. We are not encouraging the formation of new boards, however. Last year we had 135 bills in the legislature that pertained to boards and commissions, and if they had passed, we would have had 19 new boards created, an average of 7 to 10 members per board. So we keep encouraging people to look for other options and then really justify the creation of a new board.
I'd like to just commend you and the governor for the appointment of Hugh Malone to the opening on the permanent fund board. I think that was a very wise choice.
He certainly seemed to have the credentials.
Some knowledge of the family.
And he's very delighted to have been appointed.
Also, you quoted a whole list of statistics at one point, and a copy of those?
Sure.
Sure.
And on a quarterly basis, we generally do statistics about gender makeup and minority representation and geographic representation. And I'll be glad to submit those to the committee when we do them. We don't do them every month because it's much too elaborate a process to figure them out. Any other questions?
Thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you.
Okay, if you have any constituents in your area that are interested in serving on boards, let me know.
You give me the boards and I'll get you the constituents.
Well, I can find one.
Yeah, I've got a couple of just love. They don't care what board they serve.
That's right.
There's something that says I'm on this.
As long as they fit the restrictions,
Bobby?
We can do it.
Huh? Oh, yeah.
Thank
she'd
you.
Get fly to the moon if she would have put on a fingerprint board or something.
No, you're right. That's something.
I wouldn't know that at all.
Yeah.
I don't know what legislative affairs is, but I just found out myself. And, you know, where you get this bill or that bill.
The next meeting of the Labor and Commerce Committee will be Monday at 1:15. If there are no objections, I'll attend the meeting.
Monday at 1:15.
Time is 2:15.
Monday. 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 Monday.
Tomorrow's enough.